It's starting. Well, ooh, there we go.
That was kind of sexy.
That was kind of sexy, right? Well, hey, guys. Welcome to the Love Well podcast. Glad you're with me this week. And we're live streaming on Jitsi, so we're going to see how this goes. I have with me my good friend Damon Moore, and we are continuing the series on real talk, real people, where I interview some of my friends as they share about their experiences being Black in America. And most of the reality is that most of you that listen to my podcast, we're pretty much all white, and so we have no concept of what it is that so many of our friends are walking through on a daily basis. So without further ado, let's get going here. So, Damon, I have known you for, gosh, probably 15. About 15 years, would you say?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So give us a little snapshot. Where did you grow up? Where are you from? All that, you know, give us some background on you.
I am originally from Detroit, Seven and Mound. I moved when I was younger to the suburbs in Chesterfield. And then I moved again to the country when I was in high school. And back to Wayne State for college, and then I've gone on to have a lot of different jobs in my time. You know, it's a millennial thing. We don't get to retire from one job. We get to collect, you know, dozens of experiences.
That's right. That's right.
And currently I am in Roseville, and I am finishing up my master's degree in school and counseling psychology.
Nice.
And by finishing up, I mean I'll be done in like about a month or so.
Oh, my man. Love it. Congratulations, dude. I knew you were pursuing it. I didn't know you were that far in. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you.
That's very cool. So over the last few years, I know you've been teaching.
Yes.
And kind of what districts have you been in?
I've been in one district that was a charter district that is in Detroit. Been in to River Rouge, and one in St. Clair Shores. All the districts are usually serving minority populations that are lower income.
Okay. So you've kind of walked through, I mean, you and I have had so many conversations about things. It's hard to even know where to begin. One of the stories that you told me that really stuck out was, you were teaching and I can't remember who it was that walked into your classroom. But he kind of was like, "Where's the teacher?" can you tell that story? Because I think it encapsulates a lot of what folks experience.
Yes. So I was teaching in a middle class suburb, which is mostly white suburb, but the students are in this district mostly people of color, mostly Black students, because right next door there is a failing district that has, you know, essentially we've started getting a lot of their students. Anyway, this actually happened on two separate occasions. I am sitting down at my desk on one occasion talking with a student. And usually to work, I look like some version of Mr. Robbers I look like some version of of, I'm sorry, what's the guy's name?
Mr. Rogers.
Mr. Rogers, Roberts. Mr. Rogers. I look like some version of him when I go to work. I'm usually wearing a sweater and a shirt and a tie and things like that. So I'm sitting at my desk talking with a student, helping a student out in the front of the classroom. And there's an adult that works in the school, comes in and asks, hey, where's the teacher? And all the kids are like, at his desk. And I see all this unfolding. And they walk a little bit further into the room. Hey, where's the teacher? And the kids are, they're like getting borderline annoyed, angry at this point. They're like, he's at his desk. What do you mean?
Right?
And then they are literally a foot away from the student that I'm helping at this point, staring at me, saying, where's the teacher? As I'm the only, you know, full-grown man.
Right.
Looking like Mr. Rogers.
At the teacher's desk.
Yep. Yep. So, you know, most of the students didn't really understand what was happening at that moment.
Right.
Black and white kids, a few Latino kids, but they are just like, I don't understand what's going on at all right now.
Right.
And some of your listeners, viewers, may not understand the significance of that story either. So to break it down, the significance is that it's black teachers in America are a very small percentage of the population. And that's for a number of different reasons, but it shows that it was very challenging for that person to view a black person, specifically a black male, which makes up, I believe, 1 to 2% of the teaching population in the United States. It's very difficult for them to view me in a position of power, authority, and ..
Yeah.
Even though I made sense to be the only one to be in that role in the room at the time, and right. I was pointed out at least 3 times by a couple dozen students. So in America, black people have the honor of being both invisible and falsely put out front on parade.
Right. Yeah. Say more about that, because I think that's something that is something that I'm learning more about and seeing. Like I know that I'm not ever going to really be able to wrap my mind completely around that concept. But I feel like that we're seeing that more and more, especially in the last couple of weeks, of that weird balance of invisibility and yet put out on parade. So when you say that, what are you kind of, what's behind that phrase?
Black American culture is probably the most emulated culture in the entire world, maybe in the history of the world. Everybody all over the world has adopted lots of black culture. So one of the easiest ways to talk about that is to talk about music. American music is the most popular music in the world. What's the most popular American music? At least right now, it's probably hip-hop. That was created by the black community. Right. If it's not hip-hop, then it's rock, which was created by the black community. So essentially, every famous style of American music was either created by the black community or has huge influences, including country music.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
And so we also have to deal with the fact that, you know, I guess the conversation is appropriation and appreciation. There's a lot more appropriation than appreciation, because appreciation also includes being able to not just enjoy the product, but also the people that created the product. And right now, the black people, while
they may be enjoyed a little bit more than they have been historically. They are not as well received as they should be in most places around the world. And especially in America, you know, where most of my experience has been.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. So, so as you grew up, what would you say were some of the defining moments or some of the defining experiences, that you had growing up in southeastern Michigan as a young black man, you know, growing up here?
So it's actually really interesting because, you know, I went from the inner city to the suburbs, to the country, back to the city, back to the suburbs. So I've had a lot of different versions of the experience.
Right.
One of the first and earliest things that stuck out to me was I was at an elementary school in the inner city of Detroit, and I was friends with, I can only remember two other kids that I was friends with at the time. One was a black kid and one was a white kid. I think it was the only white kid in the entire school, honestly. And maybe not. It was maybe one of three. I can't remember exactly, but it was a very black neighborhood, black school. I used to get picked on by a person, and we all used to get picked on, the three of us, but I especially got a lot of it because I was friends with the white kid. There was this one kid that was a bully. And for me, that was very confusing. It just didn't make a lot of sense because I was like, man, civil rights happened like 40 years ago or 30 years ago or whatever it was at the point. I was just like, I don't, whatever. Like, and I honestly, to this day, I can't remember any of the kids' names.
Right.
But then shortly thereafter, within a couple of years, I moved to the suburbs, and the experience of racism took on a whole new meaning. The first few years of my experience at a suburban elementary school were marked with lots of racism, where people were literally, I was in second grade when we moved, and then there's about always every single day, probably 3, 4, 5 fifth grade kids. So, you know, at that point, to remind you, second graders are like the size of a jelly bean compared to.
Oh, yeah. The difference between a fifth grader and a second grader is like, I mean, you can't even compare. I mean, grown men versus little babies.
Yeah. So I will say that I've always been big. So I was maybe the size of a fifth grader, but they all knew that I was in second or third grade. I got picked on endlessly because just for being black, endlessly. You know, and my mother had to go up to the school a number of times and cuss people out. I think people might say give them a talking to.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, she had to go up there a number of times. So that was a big part of my experience from being young. I went from an elementary school with maybe one or two black kids, one or two white kids, to one with two or three black kids. Yeah. So that was a very big difference for me. Another thing that sticks out to me is when I was younger, and I have a lot of siblings that are all older than me, and I think I was still in elementary school at the time. I would have had to been. And we were pretty good relationship with the high school administrators at the high school that my siblings were going to. So one day on the front of the high school, somebody spray painted on the front, "Niggers go home." So the assistant principal, which was a wonderful little powerful Filipino lady that would not be messed with by anyone.
Right.
She brings one of my sisters into her office to, you know, check in with her and see how she's going, because, you know, there's obviously that's a lot going on right there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she says, "Hey, well, what do you think about this?" And my sister says,
well, I don't know who they're talking to. I don't see any niggers in here. Or, you know, they're not talking to me,
right,
sort of thing. So, you know, that's happening at the same time. So that wasn't my direct experience, but it was the experience in which I'm like,
yeah, I mean,
you know, it's very meaningful for me to pick out. That probably happened when she was in, I was probably in third grade at the time.
Yeah. So, I mean, even though it didn't quote unquote happen to you,
right,
the impact on you was, mm-hmm, was real and powerful for sure.
Right. And then, let's see, there is also, in high school, a few different things occurred. So, one of the most interesting things is that in middle school, and this leads into high school. When I was in middle school, I was cast as the star of a play. I did, you know, theater and drama all throughout middle school. And I was cast in my eighth grade year as the star of the play. There was a lot of actors coming up from my year going into the high school that next year. So the director of the high school plays decided to come down to the middle school and audition us for the play that they were going to be putting on in the fall. There was only one role for a black person. And as far as I knew, I was the only one in the entire, you know, school that had tried out,
right,
both middle school and high school. So I was just like, well, I'm the star of the play and there's only one role for a black person, you know, specifically a black role. I was like, well, I guess I'm going to get this then. Okay.
Right.
And so, you know, we get the cast list back. I didn't get it. And I was just like, the role is specifically written for a black person.
This, right,
is, well, okay, well, whatever. That's a little bit weird, but okay. So I didn't think much about it until the next year I tried out for the play again. And I'm cast into this play. It's called Caught in the Villain's Web.
Okay.
It's basically like Snidely Whiplash character from what is that? The Rocky and Bullwinkle show.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I'm playing like the evil guy.
Okay.
So one of the things that was really interesting to me is that the director says, by the way, you know, the high school is still pretty much all white. There's about 2,200 kids in the school. I think there's maybe 30 black kids.
Okay.
So the director says, hey, you know, I put this play on a while ago, like 20 years ago, I put this play on here and it's so exciting to do it again. I've always loved this play. And I was just like, oh, that's interesting. So years later, fast forward from sophomore year to senior year, and I have this director as an English teacher.
Okay.
And I promise the whole story's coming together for
I believe you, man.
A beautiful tragic ending.
Yeah.
So we are reading the book Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison.
Okay.
It is a novel about what it's like being a black man in America in the 1930s and 40s, 20s, 30s, 40s, feeling invisible. Mm. So I am in this class, the only black student reading this book, and we have to write a paper at the end of it. And my paper was markedly different from everybody else's paper.
I'm sure.
And I was thinking, either I'm going to get a really good grade or not. I was like, well, we'll see. So a friend of mine, he read the paper as we're about to turn him in. And he's like, well, you're right. Either you're going to do really well or really poorly. And so, because my opinion was directly different than the teacher's opinion.
Yeah.
So the teacher, eventually, you know, a few weeks later, we get the papers back. And him and another teacher that he had actually taken over for, who had been on sick leave, they had both graded the papers. And, you know, even when I first saw it, I was just like, oh, this is funnier than I could ever expect. Because he gave me a 20% and she gave me a 10%. And they both said that it was the worst paper they had ever read. And that she said that it was
let's see. She said that it was actually offensive to her to have to read it because it was a waste of her time.
What?
So overall, for this paper, I should let you know that I had spent more time on this paper than any paper that I had ever gotten before, which I A's and B's on all the other papers. And I spent about 6 hours, on this paper, and I got a 15%. Essentially, my opinion on the paper was completely opposite of theirs and how Black people should fight for their freedom.
Jeez.
And so, immediately getting that grade, I look at it, and I was just like, And so I go talk to the teacher, and I say, hey, you gave me a 15% on this. What's going on? It's like, oh, well, it just seems like you didn't really understand the book. And I looked around the room, and I thought, pretty sure I'm the only one that understood the book. And all of my friends stopped in that moment, and they're all looking, literally the whole class is just looking like, what? What is happening? And so I then explained the whole book in great detail to him in about 5 minutes.
Right.
And he's like, oh, wow, looks like you get it now. I was just like, yep, so are you going to change my grade? He's like, well, you can rewrite the paper if you want. I was like, I'll go ahead and take that grade. So fast forward to a couple weeks later where I'm looking around his classroom and I notice pictures up from old plays. And I look and I see on the wall a picture from the same play that I was in back in the early 90s. I was just like, oh, let me check this out. I was like, I wonder who played my part back then. Is it interesting that the only Black person in the entire cast in 1990 in a school that had only 30 Black people in the year 2000, that same person played the villain? Is that coincidence? Huh.
Wow.
So there's a whole lot of other stuff with that story too, including how the director had been blatantly racist to that same sister that I spoke about earlier. He never cast her in any big roles. The main role that he cast her for were, her most famous role from high school was being the maid. And she stole the show from being the maid, but she was never cast as a lead. And so this is the same person that, as we're reading this book, he decides to talk about his experience growing up in Grosse Pointe and how when the Black family moved in the neighborhood, they were just like the Huxtables. And a lot of people were upset, but he didn't mind. They were nice doctors. So this is the experience. it's so absurd. Fast forward to my friend Kyle. You know Kyle. Getting married, I was best man in his wedding, and it was at this secret club that is like a old boys club sort of thing. They just rented out for destinations for weddings and things like that. He was not in the club. The whole club consists of wealthy old white men, essentially.
Right.
So one of the old guys was there. I guess the president of the organization was there. And, he's talking to me, and it just happened to be that the club was actually a club where they perform plays and they write plays and things like that. And so, I had mentioned, oh, yeah, I went to school for theater. He's like, well, we're looking for people. He's just like, you could be in our club. Wow, you speak so well. Why do you speak so well?
Nuh-uh.
And he goes But honestly, I was willing to still get in the club just because I needed to make some connections.
Right?
I did not get in the club, though, because they wanted me to pay like $1,000 yearly dues or something. Sure. So
you speak so well.
And he went on and on and on. And I started to feed into it a little bit.
Did he pat you on the head?
Yeah, basically. So to make that a little bit more real for some of your audience,
It is a trope and a common theme in Black America to be told, oh, you speak so well. Oh, how'd you learn how to speak so well? When we are just speaking regular, normal English. Because it is expected that Black people cannot speak regular, normal English for some strange reason.
Right. Those are the things that, when we start talking about things like systemic racism, cultural racism, these kinds of big hierarchy, these big picture kinds of things, I don't think folks that look like me understand that all of that is a part of that conversation. This idea that, we should be somehow shocked and surprised when that a Black person can speak good English. It's like you grew up here. Of course you sound just like me.
Well, and also to decolonize the mind a little bit, there's no such thing as good English. Everybody right. uses slang, and English is good if you can understand it.
Exactly. Exactly.
The point of language is to communicate, and if you're doing that, then you're doing it well.
Then you're killing it. Yeah.
So to dive deeper a little bit into the you speak so well.
Yeah.
I literally just read this story this morning. A friend of mine that I've known about as long as you from college talks about how they've never told anybody this story before and how they were essentially assaulted and sexually assaulted by a police officer because who knows what reason. And one of the main reasons that the cop started to do it was because they questioned an illegal search. And they said, I don't know. I don't think this is illegal. And they're like, oh, you're mouthing off. You think you're smart. You're this, you're that. Why are you speaking like that? You're this. So I think, I don't know how many white people or how often white people are put into a dangerous or precarious position just because somebody thinks they sound intelligent.
Nobody. I mean, maybe, but I'm gonna go with nobody. Right? I mean, that's mind-boggling. So,
since we're talking about the police, when I was this was about a year outside of college. I was about 23, I believe. I am driving. I'm doing a sales job. I'm driving in my friend's car because mine had broken down. So I borrowed their car and I'm driving through the downriver area in a three-piece suit, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a cop in front of me, a couple car lengths in front of me.
Okay.
No car between us, driving down a main road. Yeah. And I pretty much drive the speed limit everywhere I go. I just too much extra to focus on. And usually my reasoning is I'm too Black for that. Mm. I can't speed and do all this other crazy stuff because the leeway, there is none for me. There's so much less ability for me to get out of something like that.
Sure.
And so I'm just driving down the street. The guy's a couple cars lengths ahead of me. And all of a sudden I see him pull into an empty, abandoned, storefront area with a huge parking lot, like an old Farmer Jack's or something.
Yeah.
And as soon as he pulled in, I was just like, oh, this guy's about to pull me over. There's literally no reason for him to pull in. I was just like, oh, he's going to pull me over. This 100%. Mind you, he had been in front of me this whole time.
Right.
And so he does a quick circle, pulls back behind me, turns on the light, pulls me over. And I'm just, why? Why? So he comes to the window. Is this your car? Nope. Well, I didn't think so. And I'm just staring at him. Okay. He's like, it's my friend's car. He's like,
well, yeah, I didn't think you had blue eyes. So what that means for people is that he had already been running the car and been searching it the whole time that he was in front of me and trying to figure out what was going on. Because he'd already ran the plate by the time he pulled back behind me. And this was like seconds. So, you know, he didn't think I had blue eyes because, you know, I borrowed the car from a friend of mine that is white. And it was their car. And he had already looked him up. However, he should have already been able to look up. It wasn't stolen. So he then says to me, and well, you know, this is the most stolen car in Michigan, one of the most stolen cars in Michigan. And so then I say, okay, what does that have to do with me?
Right.
And he's like, well, I'll be right back. So he takes my paperwork, my license, all that, and goes back to the car. To narrate what I assume what he was doing is trying to find all the warrants that he thought that I had, yeah. Which I've never been arrested or warranted or any of this or that. So he comes back in a huff and he says, well, you know, your tags, it's, you know, out of date. It's expired. You got to get that fixed. I was like, is it? So he's like, this is just a warning. I'm not going to give you a ticket. I was like, okay. So at that point, he leaves. And I'm just sitting there. I was just like, something feels wrong about this. I mean, obviously, multiple things.
Multiple things, right.
But I go and look at the license plate. Definitely not expired. It expired in 3 weeks, but it was not expired.
Right.
So a lot of people like to say, you know, there's only a few bad apples. I'm not going to say that every cop is bad, but I've just given very clear, thoughtful stories in both education and policing, how there are systemic issues that my story is one of a million. My stories are one of a million. There's nothing uncommon about these things that have happened to me.
Yeah.
And they happen repeatedly over and over and over and over again. And if they don't make you question or ask if that's normal or typical, that's concerning to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So as you continue to think through this, process this, what are kind of, you know, when you hear somebody say, okay, well, that's great, Damon, these are hard things. This is really sad. You know, you know, that sounds like you've had some bad experiences. So, you know, and maybe you've got friends that have experienced the same thing. So how do you fix it? When someone says, okay, so tell me how to fix it. What's your response to that? Like, what do you say to that?
You're asking the wrong question.
Say more.
How do I fix it? That's for you to figure out. That's not on me. Asking someone how to fix it is like victim blaming in another way. It is not my responsibility to fix your life. And I say your life because racism is a part of everybody's life in America. And that doesn't mean that everybody's, you know, out and out racist, but I cannot fix the things in your life that you need to work on. So in order for you to be able to fix those things, you have to be introspective. You have to be thoughtful. You have to be able to hold space for people and stories that you have never held space for before. You have to be able to be willing to see a new perspective. You have to be able to be open to seeing that there are more than just one
version of the truth and more experiences that are true than just yours or those of the people that you know. Yeah. So when people ask me how to fix the problem, I'm going to, and not in a mean way, but I'm going to assume that they're not going to be helpful. Because they're probably going to be thinking and thinking and thinking. And coming from an overthinking type person, it's not going to get us anywhere.
Right.
To continually think and think and think and think and think and think and chew on and ruminate. And like, if you want to bring some thoughts of, hey, I see that these things are happening and I see that this is unjust, or this is how I've addressed things in my life, do it. There are plenty of places for you to be able to research. There are plenty of stories for you to hear if you want to search for them. What I am not about is someone saying, oh yeah, I'm in the fight. But they're only in the fight long enough to finish that tweet.
That's right.
They're only in the fight long enough to not be bored anymore. They're only in the fight, you know.
So wait, you're saying that virtue signaling on social media is not really being in the fight?
Precisely.
Shocking, you know? Oh.
And so I guess.
Oh no. Come back. We may have lost him. We'll see if we can get him back here. Hopefully Damon will come back. So while we're kind of waiting to see if my man will be able to get back on here, we've got a little technical difficulty, so I'm going to do this, and we are going to stay live here, and hopefully Damon can get back on. I think what we're hearing a lot here with Damon is the importance of all of us doing the work that we need to do. And I think Damon is back. Yes, he's back. All right.
Was it just me that dropped?
Yep. Yep.
I don't know.
I think, you know, I lost you there for a second. So, so I'm not sure how far you got. You didn't get very far in what you were just saying before we lost signal.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I noticed instantly. So the point is, if you want to know what you can do, listen. You can keep the space for people. And so listen and keep the space. They go hand in hand. And that a lot of people think they're listening, but they're waiting to retort and come up with something else to, you know, contrast what somebody says, or to make themselves look smart, or to defend the thing they didn't like.
So
true listening has an element of taking it in and a consideration of like, this is going to be with me for a while so I can chew on it.
Yeah.
And I think we have to listen even to the other side, or to sides that we never knew existed.
Yep.
And hold space for those things. And then when you hear the story and you are entrusted with the stories that I've entrusted you and your audience with, it is then your responsibility in the conversation to share those stories in a meaningful way with other people who have not heard the stories. It is your responsibility to call out the people in your lives that need the calling out.
Yeah.
It is your responsibility for calling out yourself.
And I think that's the calling out ourselves has to start first, right? I mean, that's step number one. And then, yeah, you know, I love how you put that, that you have entrusted us with your stories. And that's something that I don't want to take lightly, because I think that's you giving me the time today to just listen. Dude, I can't thank you enough for that. And also just kind of getting a sense of, at least from a lot of my friends that I've talked to, these days are exhausting. They're just hard. And so the emotional, spiritual, even physical bandwidth, just, you know, for you to give me this time, I'm grateful, man. I'm really grateful.
You're welcome.
So I have one last question for you. And it's one I want to make sure that we touch on, if you still got a few more minutes.
Yeah, I got time.
So one of the things that I see you share consistently about is challenging the myth of the absent Black father. This seems like a lot of things that I hear as people discuss a lot of these issues is, you know, well, there's no, you know, Black fathers aren't involved in their children's lives. That's why we have all these problems. And I see you consistently push against that, cultural myth, I guess you could say. So could you just kind of share a little bit more about some of the reality that we see within the family structure in the Black community? Because I think that myth is one that's risen to like trope level. You know,
it's really interesting that the myth is as persistent and pervasive as it is, because people that willingly and knowingly create the myth don't usually try to scare those immediate people next to them into believing the myth as well. But, you know, white America has specifically created a myth that says that Black fathers are absent, and they've actually perpetuated the myth in a number of different ways. So one of the last things I posted on being a Black father in America, maybe a month ago or so, was that Black fathers, there's been multiple studies show that Black fathers are the most ingrained and interactive in their children's lives, and they spend the most time compared to white and Latinos, I believe also Asians as well. So in America, Black fathers, by most statistics, are technically the best dads.
Yeah.
So they spend more time on a regular basis with their kids, according to the studies.
Mm-hmm.
They interact in more meaningful ways, according to the studies. So why is this myth so persistent and pervasive? You know, there's a lot of anecdotal stories that people like when we're talking about racism, and then they say, well, that doesn't really count because it's just your own individual story. I can talk about how I'm pretty sure I spend more time with my kids than just about anybody else. And I'm super hella busy.
Right, right.
But I don't think that story is going to be meaningful. What I would love to be meaningful is a historical story for you. So the first government housing projects, I believe it was, or at least one of the first, was in New York. It was built, was this New York? Yeah, I think. I believe this was the same one that was built by the same guy that designed the Twin Towers and a few other places. He basically said he wished he had never done that project before. Mm. And he had never designed it. A part of the history of that is that there was a lot of people that were unable to get assistance for their family, poorer people, both white and Black. But especially the Black families, they were unable to get assistance from the government if they listed that a man was living in the house.
So systemically, the system back in the 1950s, I believe, pushed the black fathers out of the houses. Now you could say, well, why were they so poor? Why couldn't they do their own thing?
Yep.
That's a whole other systemic education.
Right.
In that when black America has built things up, they are repeatedly, historically, torn down by white America. I would encourage you to research Black Wall Street and other things like the MOVE bombings and things like that, where there have been things that have been built up, organizations or wealth, and they've been destroyed. So in America, a person that desperately needs assistance, which a large percent of a black America is going to be needing assistance because we have some of the highest numbers of poverty. But if you are also needing assistance and you have a man in the house, then you don't get the assistance. So a lot of the black men were erased because the families were like, hey, we need assistance. And the dads were like, yeah, we do. I can't get a job because this. I can't get a job because they're only hiring white guys. This is all, you know, these are the things. So this story says that black males were forced out of the house on an economic basis. The pop culture story says that black dads are just bad fathers.
Yep. Yeah. And so it's mind-boggling the power of myth it's so significant. And I think, you know, and I just wonder, you know, is part of the reason we like to buy into this myth because it's really just a projection of the failure of white fathers, majority culture fathers, right? So we, you know, as I look around a lot of the kids that my son's, you know, that my son is friends with, or I even think about my own experience growing up. I mean, you know, a lot of our dads just weren't around. And so it's a lot easier to say, well, we're not as bad as those black dads, you know. and when the reality is just not true, right?
So
it's just this projection of, well, we're not going to embrace our own failures, so we're just going to project this over here on these people over here, because man, that's a whole lot easier than actually dealing with our own issues.
And it's also, it makes you feel good to paint yourself, you know, as a hero, mm-hmm. even though you may be the villain.
That's right. That's right.
You can justify an awful lot when you say, but you know, I really am the best thing.
I really am the best. I am so good. I'm so good at all the things. I'm the best at the things.
Yep.
Oh, Damon, brother, thank you so much for being a part of this conversation. And I am also really grateful that in a few weeks you've agreed to come back on and be a part of a conversation with a guy who, you know, kind of looks at things and says, yeah, systemic racism, not real. So
I have a question. What ethnicity is that person?
I'll give you a guess. He would be an Anglo-Saxon.
So it's okay. I'm 12% Irish, so we'll be fine.
See? I'm Irish too, so we're good.
But the Irish were slaves too, so it's fine.
That's right. Let's not go that route, right? Oh my God. Oh.
I am excited to have this this conversation with him. And so when those pointers that I gave, what work, you know, what can you do? Those are the same things that I'll be using when I talk to this guy. I'm going to hold space for him. I'm going to listen. I'm going to take his story with me and let it change me. That doesn't mean that, you know, I'm going to win some argument that I don't plan on happen. Right. That doesn't mean that, you know, we're both going to change our opinions or whatever.
Right.
But I guarantee you, we will come to a healthy, wholehearted conclusion.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and part of, you know, part of the good is having the discussion, right? There's a philosopher that I like, a guy named Peter Rollins. And he makes the argument that war and violence are the things that happen when you decide not to engage in conflict anymore. Mm-hmm. And I keep processing that reality because it's like, yeah, you know, conflict happens in the context of conversation and discourse and in community. But you know, when you decide you're not willing to have the conflict anymore, that's when you're basically saying, we're not doing this any longer. And so to be able to have some, you know, some of these kinds of dialogues and conversations, I think are going to be good, hopefully. Or they might be lousy. I don't know. We're going to find out. So, Damon, thanks for being on. And guys, we'll be back. We'll be back in a few weeks with Damon and a guy named Nick Stumphauser, who's going to kind of be a conversation partner, and I'll moderate, and we'll just kind of see how that goes. But next week, I think next week I've got my friend Tyler St. Clair from Detroit. He's going to be on with us, and we're going to continue sharing stories. If this has been meaningful to you, I would encourage you to share it with your friends, let people know about the podcast, subscribe to my Love Well channel at danielmrose.com, where you can receive the things I write and publish, and I usually publish about 3 to 5 times a week, and it goes right in your inbox when you subscribe. And also, you know, or if you're more into the video thing, subscribe to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Daniel Rose. But until next week, love well, my friends.